Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Joni Griffith. She just completed a 3,180-mile bike ride across the country. I'll talk with her about what she learned along the way. But first, we all remember when in 2012, former Penn State football coach Jerry Sandusky was sent to prison, convicted of 45 counts of child sexual abuse. One of the children he abused was his adopted son, Matthew Sandusky. After Matthew Sandusky learned that he was not his father's only victim, he has dedicated his adult life to preventing childhood sexual abuse and helping other survivors heal. He founded the Peaceful Hearts Foundation, and he'll be in Iowa this week supporting another organization that works with the survivors of sexual assault. He'll be giving the keynote address Wednesday evening at the Riverview Center's Evening of Light. That's May 8th at 5 p.m. at the Hilton Garden Inn in Cedar Falls. And in a few minutes, I'll bring Joey Taylor, Executive Director of the Riverview Center, into the conversation. But first, Matthew Sandusky is with me on the line. Hello, Matthew.
Hello. How are you doing this morning?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today. And I know you've told your story so many times, but I'm going to ask you to tell it again today. I know you had a very, very difficult early childhood coming from a biological family where your father was physically abusive. Can you tell me when you first encountered Jerry Sandusky?
I first encountered him when I was around 8 years old. He had started a program called the Second Mile Program to help disadvantaged youth. And it was at a summer camp that they held each year on the campus of Penn State. And that's where I first had contact with him.
And at that point in your life, were you in foster care? What was your living situation?
No, I still lived with my biological mom. And we lived with my grandparents and, you know, all of my aunts and cousins. There was a huge family that lived in a very small, rundown home, but I still lived with my biological family.
As you got to know Jerry Sandusky, you've said that even from those early days when you were 8 years old, he was like a father figure to you. And this was an exciting time for you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because of where I came from, I was never shown love. I was never given, you know, any type of affection. And it was something that I was desperately seeking. And so when he came into my life, he filled that void, as a father figure, as a loving adult, and really gave me the things that I was searching for most in my young childhood life.
And he included you in family moments with the Sandusky family. How did that feel?
It felt wonderful and it felt great. And that's what I try and tell people as well, is that, you know, 90% of the time that I had spent with the Sanduskys and with this man is everything that I wish every child would have the opportunity to have. But, you know, there was obviously that 10% of the time where he did those other things that were very painful and destructive to my childhood as well. But, I mean, as I spent more and more time with the Sandusky family, it just pulled me in closer to him and, you know, further away from my biological family.
When did you officially become a part of the Sandusky family?
Well, I was placed in foster home in their home when I was 16 years old, and I was not officially adopted until I was 18 years old.
Okay, but during the years before, you were spending a lot of time with the Sanduskys. And although in many of the articles written about you, it says that the abuse happened from when you were 10 years old to when you were 17 years old, but you can actually look at those early times, even when you were 8 or 9 years old, and you can see the beginning of this kind of physical abuse, the grooming you for this abuse, right?
Absolutely. And that's why I say I was sexually victimized from the age of 8 to 17, because really from the very first moment he had a conversation with me, he knew what his intentions were. And so that was his start of the grooming process. And it started with just a basic, simple conversation, just to show interest in me and to get me, you know, interested in him as well.
When you were older and this abuse was going on, did you have anyone that you could talk to about what was happening?
No, I mean, I never really had anybody that I could talk to. There was nobody ever really trying to, you know, look at but that possibility for reasons in, you know, my behavior changes and such. And ultimately, too, especially as a young boy, there's a lot of stigmas that society places on us. And those really helped keep my mouth shut as well. I was never going to disclose what he was doing to me. Just really, those were more impactful on me, you know, than just if I would have been educated, if I would have had somebody reaching out to me. But there was never anybody trying to protect me. Everybody always pushed me back to him. Whenever I tried to escape or get away from him, you know, I was labeled a bad kid at a very early age. And then he was seen as this savior. Part of his grooming process of, you know, the community of society was he painted himself as a savior of children. And so every time, you know, I was, you know, showed a behavior that was not acceptable, you know, they would push me back to him. They thought I needed more of him in my life because he could correct me. And not really taking a good look at how I really needed to be saved.
You must have felt so isolated. I mean, you were really alone.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's unfortunately what a lot of children are going through, but not only as children, as we get older and turn into adults, survivors of this, you know, we still feel alone. We still feel unsupported. And that's why I do what I'm doing now.
You actually were so distressed and so alone, you even tried to take your own life. And I know you were unsuccessful in doing that. And that opened the door to more emotional abuse from Jerry Sandusky. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Again, just as a child trying to deal with these, what he was doing to me, you know, I was trying to find ways to cope, drugs, alcohol, self-mutilation, self-harm. And when I ran through all of those and they weren't working anymore, then, yeah, I'm feeling so alone, feeling that no one, you know, he's never going to stop what he's doing to me. It ended up in, you know, myself attempting to take my own life. Fortunately, yes, I am here today. But it just, you know, it was something that should, again, been a red flag to people to get me out of that home. But they kept me there. And yes, I was still subjected to his, you know, torment and just his power control over me.
When did you learn that you were not his only victim?
Well, when the grand jury presentment came out, I still, you know, was in a haze of just trying to get away from all of it. But when I sat in the courtroom on the very first day and I saw victim four speak his truth, it was really in that moment where I truly realized that he had actually done these things to other people.
How did that feel?
It felt a lot of things. It was just crushing. It was, I mean, I had so much guilt that just came to the top of everything because all of the young men who he is convicted of and sitting in prison because he, you know, sexually victimized them were younger than I. And so I had a lot of guilt that maybe if I would have spoken up, if I would have said something, I could have protected them. I could have stopped it before he got to them. And it just created a lot of confusion, hurt, pain, every emotion that you can imagine.
You are the founder of the Peaceful Hearts Foundation to help other survivors of this kind of abuse. When do you feel like you got the help that you needed to start working through this abuse? Because as we know, this kind of abuse affects you throughout a lifetime.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, for me, honestly, I am amazingly blessed with a wonderful wife who I wish, you know, every survivor would have this type of person when they disclose for the first time, because she has been nothing but supportive of me throughout everything. And that has been the largest you know, component of my healing process that has allowed me to really get to where I'm at today. And her love and support, you know, I went into therapy, I worked hard in therapy, still continue to work in therapy each and every week. And so, you know, really, I, as I travel and I speak, I give all credit to my wife. You know, yes, I put in the hard work of therapy. I put in the hard work of coming through this, but without her love and support and just being there for me, you know, and she's dealt with a lot of backlash as well throughout this whole process of, you know, and so it's just our family unit, my wife and my children, all of us have allowed me to get to a place where I am today.
Do you feel like you have found peace?
Yeah, I mean, I believe that I have peace. I believe that, you know, I love my life. I have a blessed life today. I get to enjoy time with my children. Just, you know, those everyday normal things that I never had before. And the number one thing is really being able to give love and receive love. That is the one thing that was always, you know, I could never do that because of what he had done to me and that betrayal of trust, because of that abuse, you know, he had wrecked for me. So it took a while to build that back and really understand what it means to love somebody and to be able to be open to being loved as well.
I'm talking with Matthew Sandusky. His father, Jerry Sandusky, was sent to prison in 2012, convicted of 45 counts of child sexual abuse. And Matthew Sandusky is in Iowa this week. He'll be here on Wednesday as part of the Riverview Center's Evening of Light. The Riverview Center is an organization that provides sexual assault services in a 14-county region of northeastern Iowa, as well as part of Illinois. He'll be the keynote speaker Wednesday evening at 5 p.m. at the Hilton Garden Inn in Cedar Falls. And we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. I'm also going to bring Joey Taylor, executive director of the Riverview Center, into the conversation as well in just a moment. And this is some information that might be important to some people in our audience today. The National Sexual Assault Hotline is free and confidential. It is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and the number is 800-656-4673. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up a little later this hour, I'll talk with Joni Griffith, who just biked 3,180 miles across the United States. I'll talk with her about what she learned along the way. Right now, we're talking about efforts to prevent childhood sexual abuse and also to help victims of childhood sexual abuse. With me is Matthew Sandusky. He is the adopted son of Jerry Sandusky, the former Penn State football coach who went to prison for sexually abusing a number of children, convicted of 45 counts of child sexual abuse. Matthew Sandusky will be giving the keynote address Wednesday evening at the Riverview Center's Evening of Light. That's on May 8th at 5 p.m. at the Hilton Garden Inn in Cedar Falls. And I also want to bring Joey Taylor into the conversation now, executive director of the Riverview Center, which is an organization that provides sexual assault services in a 14-county region in northeastern Iowa, as well as sexual or domestic violence services in two counties in Illinois. Joey, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And listening to Matthew's story, I know that you are familiar with his story and with so many stories of childhood sexual assault. And it's difficult to listen to Matthew's story without drawing parallels to the recent conviction of Greg Stephen of Monticello, who was a youth basketball coach here in Iowa and was sentenced to 180 years in prison for soliciting explicit images, capturing secret video and photos, and inappropriately touching hundreds of boys over the course of 20 years. With that story touching so many Iowans right now, Joey, what is your reaction? I mean, this is something that we know that happens, but we can't seem to be able to prevent it.
That's right. And the reality is we get calls too often after the fact saying, what could we be watching for? What should we, in terms of grooming behavior for my children and how do I talk to my children and what can we do to prevent this? And so that's why, you know, we look at an opportunity to bring someone like Matthew Sandusky to our region to talk about not only the story about what happened to him, but really to find ways to help prevent this before it occurs. We know the prevalence is extreme. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people think this is rare until it happens within their own family. The reality is about 500,000 children annually are assaulted, sexually assaulted in the United States. The statistics show that 1 out of every 5 girls and 1 out of every 20 boys is a victim of child sexual abuse. And so the reality is that's what we need to do is focus on how we can work to prevent this.
Well, and we know that it's prevalent, but we also have a hard time imagining that it could happen to our child or that someone in our child's life could be a perpetrator. It's important to understand that so many of the perpetrators are people who are known to us and known to our children, right?
That's right. You know, we do such a great job as our children are being raised, teaching them about stranger danger. But the prevalence of sexual assault happens typically within close inner circles. About 90% of children who are assaulted by people that are very well known and oftentimes beloved family members of ours.
Well, Matthew, I know that you speak to so many groups and do so much work to try to prevent sexual assault of children. What do you want to add to that? I mean, we hear that over and over again, and yet it's still very difficult for us to spot these dangers. What should people know?
Yeah, I mean, you guys are giving great information, and, you know, as may have been already been stated, but I think it's important to understand that 93 to 95% of all child sexual victimization happens at the hands of somebody that is already in the child's life, as you stated, you know, somebody that the child already knows, loves, cares about. And we need to understand that these people put themselves into positions where they can be close to children. You know, in your case that you just stated about the basketball coach, mine was a football coach, but they can be preachers, pastors, you know, librarians. And so really it's what I tell people, the most important thing to always remember is to trust your gut. If you feel as though something isn't right, if you feel as though something is off, then you have to take it upon yourself to protect that child and do something about it.
Well, and Joey, you mentioned we do a great job teaching our children about stranger danger. What should we be talking to them about to help them realize or to help them develop a radar of when they might be in danger?
You know, I think Matthew mentioned in kind of in your earlier conversation, there was a question about if he had anyone to talk to. I think the biggest thing is to keep open lines of communication with your children. Don't be afraid to talk. I know it's a touchy subject. It's like sex education. Nobody really wants to have that conversation. But the reality is if it's going to help protect your children, won't you want to do that with us? You know, oftentimes, you know, there's this myth, this belief system that this happens to poor inner city kids with zero resources. And that's not always the truth. This happens across socioeconomic boundaries. As long as kids know that they have someone that they can talk to and that parents are asking questions, like Matthew said, to trusting your gut, recognizing parents and trusted adults should recognize signs and symptoms. Be very careful in talking with your children, making sure that you avoid judgment, placing blame, and just really helping to kind of open that line of communication to create a supportive role as a trusted adult.
One of the things that I've talked to my children about over the years is that if any adult asks them to keep a secret from me, that's a danger sign. I think I read that in an article once. Is that good advice to say if any adult tells you not to tell your parents about something, that's maybe the first thing you should tell your parents about?
That is absolutely. That's wonderful advice. You know, and keeping in mind kind of the grooming steps, you know, people will, again, they typically are people within an inner circle who are the perpetrators. And so making sure that your children know not to create secrecy around those relationships, watch for isolation, an opportunity to get your children alone, kind of controlling behavior in those relationships. This really is about power and control. And so trying to stop that at all costs as it relates to your children.
Well, Matthew was talking about some of the behavior changes that he went through. And of course, Matthew's behaviors didn't set off alarm bells for people. That didn't help him become identified as a victim. But what are some of those behaviors that should be setting off alarm bells, if changes that we might see in our children or in their friends?
Well, you know, there's obviously there's some physical signs, so things like bleeding or bruising in a genital area, difficulty walking or sitting, frequent urination or yeast infections can be some of the more physical signs. But behaviorally, Matthew had mentioned attempted suicide, oftentimes things like regressed behavior. So maybe a child who's a little bit older who begins to thumb suck again or bedwet, oftentimes that can be a sign. Troubles in school where troubles didn't exist, maybe refusing to bathe, or the alternate side is wanting to bathe excessively. You know, those might be some of the either physical or behavioral signs that, that children may exhibit.
Yeah, Matthew, is there anything you, you want to add to that as you remember what it was like as a teenager trying to get attention, trying to help people understand that you were in trouble, or maybe you weren't thinking about that consciously at all, but anything else we should be thinking about?
No, I mean, that is all great advice and great things to pay attention to. The only thing I guess that I would add just to kind of sum all of that up would be to be watching for, you know, great changes in behavior. And to explain that really quickly, for me, I was a very shy, reserved child when I was younger, did fairly well in school. As the abuse started happening to me, I turned into an ultra-aggressive person, an ultra-aggressive child where I was getting into fights. I was not listening to any authority. And so my behavior really did an entire 180. And that should have been a huge red flag to people to pay attention that, you know, I was a child needing help and that they should investigate that more.
I'm talking with Matthew Sandusky. He's the founder of the Peaceful Hearts Foundation, helping survivors of sexual assault, working to prevent sexual assault of children. Also with me, Joey Taylor, executive director of the Riverview Center, which serves 14 counties in northeastern Iowa that provide sexual assault services. Joey, when you find out that something has happened to a child in your life, what do you do?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. Whether you find out that something's happened or even if you suspect something's happened, call your local sexual assault crisis service center. You mentioned the 800 number for the National Sexual Assault Hotline just a little bit ago. And those calls are answered 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they're routed to local crisis service centers. So we can be available 24 hours a day to help. We will oftentimes report to law enforcement centers if someone shows up there. Hospital response, we will always be there immediately if someone presents at an emergency room with suspected childhood sexual abuse or even as an adult. But the reality is, you know, you can always call our center and we can walk through that process with you. I think it's so important across the state of Iowa for people to recognize there is not 1 cent of a charge for any of the services that we provide, and they are 100% confidential. We're very fortunate through the through VAWA, so the Violence Against Women Act, or VOCA, Victim of Crime Assistance Funds, that we basically are able to provide those services at all times 100% free of charge. We will never ask if you have insurance. And so we're available to help bridge those services, whether it be emergency, medical, or legal advocacy, whether it be long-term counseling services. We even do a lot with prevention work in all of the communities that we serve. And again, all those services are free of charge. So if anyone has suspected case of abuse, the first call I would make is to your local sexual assault crisis services center.
I can imagine that's a really difficult call for a lot of people to make. As you mentioned, more than 90% of these crimes are perpetrated by people who are already in your life, sometimes a relative. Does that complicate the reporting process as people are sometimes reporting somebody that they love?
It certainly does. And I'll tell you, sexual assault and sexual abuse is the most underreported crime in the United States. And so you know, that's a big part of why. When you call your local crisis services center, though, we don't direct you to report or not report to law enforcement. We basically give you options and walk with you through every step of that process. But, you know, oftentimes that's a big concern. People don't make that initial call because they think, I don't want to have to, you know, do the report to with a law enforcement center, and that does not necessarily have to ever happen. And so, but we can walk you through kind of the do's and don'ts and some of the reasons why you would or wouldn't want to do that.
Matthew, I want to ask you, as a survivor of this kind of abuse, when something like this has happened, what do you feel is the most important thing to do for the victim, for the survivor?
I mean, the number one thing that any of us can do is believe them and let them know that we believe them. You know, just love and support them. Be there for them. Don't say you have all the answers. Don't tell them it's going to be okay. Just be honest with them. But always be there beside their, you know, right there with them through every step of this process. And that's the most important thing that any of us can do for any survivor, no matter what age, you know, they are at. It's number one is to believe, and number two is just to love and support.
You were not able to escape this abuse until you became an adult and were able to get out of the situation yourself. But I know you've worked with many children who are survivors. What do you feel people can do to make sure that their child feels safe after something, or a child in their life feels safe after something like this has happened?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. But I think that is, you know, like the Riverview Center and the services that they offer, that's what helps these children. When we get to them early, children are very resilient. And when we get them the help that they need very early, they do heal from this. They do, you know, come back, and trust is restored, and they go on to live loving, beautiful lives. And that's the most important thing and reason why we have to educate ourselves and why we have to make this a priority, you know, in conversations as adults. We have to take this responsibility upon ourselves to protect them, you know, and really to save their childhoods for them and keep them safe. But it ultimately, children are so resilient, and we see it every day as they go through the process, as they heal, they come out the other side beautiful, strong, trusting children.
When you were going through the process of healing from this, I mean, Matthew, you talked about, you know, how dark things got for you, but also then when you discovered you were not the only victim of Jerry Sandusky, feeling guilt, feeling like you should have been able to protect these other children. I know a lot of victims of these crimes feel guilt as if they've done something to bring it on themselves. Was there a moment for you, something you can share that helped you let go of that in your healing process?
Yeah, I don't know if there was one specific moment. It's truly the process as a whole that has gotten me to where I'm at today. But the most important thing that led me or got me on track was in sitting down and having a conversation with another survivor. And I remember sitting with that survivor, looking across the table at him as he was speaking what had happened to him. And I remember thinking, how can he be so strong? How can he talk about these things that he had been through, you know, the way that he's doing it? And really, you know, it was in that moment where he empowered me to heal, to fight. And that's what I do. That's what I'm trying to do in speaking my truth, in telling my story. It's really to empower survivors everywhere that I go to find their voices, to speak their truth, because what happened to them was not their fault. They hold, you know, no accountability for that. And they need to let that go. And, you know, by speaking our truth, using our voices, that helps get us onto the path of healing. And through that path, we all can live joy-filled lives.
Well, Matthew Sandusky, thank you so much for sharing your story so many times. I'm sure that has really helped so many survivors and so many people prevent this kind of crime. But thank you for sharing it with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Matthew Sandusky is the founder of the Peaceful Hearts Foundation. He will be in Iowa this week on Wednesday, giving the keynote address at the Riverview Center's Evening of Light. That's at 5 p.m. at the Hilton Garden Inn in Cedar Falls. And Joey Taylor, thank you so much for being part of the conversation today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Joey Taylor is executive director of the Riverview Center, which is an organization that provides sexual assault services in a 14-county region of northeastern Iowa, as well as sexual or domestic violence services in Joe Davies County and Carroll counties in Illinois. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Joni Griffith. She just finished riding her bicycle from South Carolina to California, 3,180 miles along the way. I'll talk with her about her journey and what she learned in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.